Three, two, one, Stinkworks.
All movie talk.
In a world where movies get talked about, two men have the courage to take a stand on things like weird movie jobs. In a world without answers, a question is asked. A man is put to the test, and everything he thought he stood for comes crashing about him. He's gonna learn a thing or two about learning to love. When everything you know is wrong, they will separate fact from fiction. In the world of the rich and famous, the rich and famous have idiosyncrasies. In a world where there's a world of worlds, there's a world of top six lists. But if you listen to one segment this episode, listen to Top Six Movie Trailers. And then, just when you thought it was over, just when you thought it was safe to turn up the volume, he's here! Preston Sturges! All Movie Talk, Part 50, coming to iPods near you, right now. I'm Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen... Why are we talking like that anyway? I'm Stephen Keller.
Oh, man. I actually kind of got a sore throat.
Movie trailer stuff is great. So I guess a little bit of business before we get started. I want to let everyone know, while we appreciate everyone listening, this is going to be one of our final episodes. We're going to close out after we've had a full year. It'll be episode 52 on September 25th. So I guess, including this episode, there are three more coming at you, three more new ones. So be sure to listen to all of them, and we appreciate everyone who has listened to us and supported us over the last year. And now I guess we'll get on with the show. One of the great things about Hollywood is all the weird names for jobs. If you watch the credits, like both Sam and I tend to do in movies, one of the fun things is looking at all the crazy titles they come up with for people. But some of the most common ones are also some of the strangest ones. You know, I think you can probably figure out what maybe the editor or the director of photography does if you think about it. But what about the gaffer and the grip and the best boy? It sounds like three people from a nursery rhyme, right? I think that is, in fact, the gaffer, the grip, and the best boy were in a barrel or a tub. I don't know. Anyway, so what do these three jobs mean? They're actually related to one another. So the gaffer on a movie is the head electrician, and he supervises the various other electricians, also known as the lighting technician. Sometimes the gaffer is the chief lighting technician, something like that. Basically, they're the guys who are going to run all the wires and actually set up all the lights. The gaffer is going to generally work for the director of photography, a.k.a. the cinematographer, because it's the cinematographer's job to make sure the shots are lit correctly, but the cinematographer isn't going to be hauling around and setting up lights himself. That's the job of people a little lower on the totem pole, and so that's the gaffer's job. In fact, you'll sometimes hear electrical tape referred to as gaffer tape. Even outside the movie industry, you'll hear that term, you know, that black electrical tape, something's called gaffer tape. So that's their job. They got to run all the wires. They're responsible for making sure all the lights are set up the way they're supposed to be and that they're working correctly. And, you know, that's actually a pretty big task if you think about it. You can't make a movie unless you have light. I know nothing to record if there's no light coming into the camera. And there's a whole lot of wires. Got to keep it all straight. And, you know, pretty difficult thing to do. Got to make sure it's all running. Got to be fast. A lot of the, you know, the people who are working kind of the lower down the totem pole, below the line, so to speak, in the industry terms, is that, you know, they got to be fast and efficient. And one thing worth thinking about is that the people who work these kinds of jobs that aren't the big stars or even the big creative forces like director and stuff, these guys are also, generally speaking, the best in their industry because it's competitive for these jobs, just like it is any job in Hollywood. Well, closely related to the gaffer and the other lighting technicians are the grips. And the head grip is called the key grip, usually. And it's another one of those weird terms. And the grips are responsible for two sort of areas. One is they're going to be really responsible to things related to cameras. They'll help set up the riggings, the dollies, that kind of stuff that's necessary for cameras. And they're going to set up most of the other things that involve elevating things on a movie set. So they're going to, you know, set up poles and stuff for the lights to sit on. Now, it's going to be the actual lighting technicians and the gaffer who are going to be actually setting the lights into the riggings that the grips are responsible for, but those riggings are held by the grips. The grips are also, like I said, involved in all sorts of aspects relating to the camera. Now, they're not necessarily going to be the ones operating the camera, but they will, you know, the camera's got to sit on something, it's got to be set up somewhere, and it's going to be the job of the grips, who are supervised by the key grip. Now, there's another term you'll see all the time, which is best boy, and boy, that just sounds really silly and funny. And
I think that's a member of a wedding party.
Yeah, no kidding, huh? It sounds like a really diminutive term, and it goes back, I guess, all the way to the old apprentice systems, where a master at a particular trade would have all these different apprentices who are younger boys, and his best apprentice was his best boy, because the best boy is going to be the number two in command. So the best boy grip is the second grip in charge, and the best boy electrician is the second guy who reports to the gaffer. So, it's the assistant to the head of the various jobs. So you'll see it used for both the grips and the gaffers, this term best boy, and hopefully I've helped you navigate this weird little nursery rhyme that can be the movie industry.
Yeah, I got one to add, actually.
Okay.
And that is script girl.
Oh, good one.
Script girl. Why it's a girl, I don't know. It doesn't have to be. But they call it a script girl, and it really has nothing to do with the script. I mean, sort of, but it's funny. You think that the script girl will be, I don't know, maybe not the writer, but maybe the person in charge of photocopying the script. No, it turns out to be the person in charge of continuity. And it's the person who's sitting at the set and for every shot takes all these copious notes about, okay, in this take, this shot, the actor ended it with his left hand held this way and his right hand held this way and his face looking this way, so that when they get back together the next day or the next month or whatever to do the shot that's supposed to follow from another angle or something, they do the scene again from another angle, then she has the notes and can provide the actor with the information about how he should start the shot or end the shot with his hands positioned thus and looking this way. But they call it the script girl. It's a very unintuitive term.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
And even the best script girl can't possibly deal with the size and relative smokiness of cigarettes. If you ever want to find continuity errors in movies, just wait for someone to smoke and check out the length of the cigarette from shot to shot.
Right.
No one can deal with that, so you've got to... A little bit of movie magic.
Or if there's a candle in the middle of a table or something.
Yeah. Right, just impossible. They don't even try.
Yeah. Time for a trivia question. We'll have a short preview in the process. We're going to be talking about Westerns very shortly on the show, not this episode, starting next. And so we'll have a trivia question about Westerns. This is a tricky one, but so it's going to be multiple choice, because I don't want to be too difficult on you, Stephen. But it's about the movie My Darling Clementine from 1946, the great Western from John Ford, about Wyatt Earp. And the question is, okay, which of these actors did not star in My Darling Clementine? So is it going to be A, Henry Fonda, B, Linda Darnell, C, Victor Mature, D, Walter Brennan, E, Ward Bond, or F, Snoop Dogg? So think about that. You got six choices here to choose from. When we get to the end of the episode, I'll tell you which was the correct answer. So see if you can think of it and write down your guess on a piece of paper somewhere and grade yourselves. Be honest. Grade yourself on a scale of 0 to 1. So if you get 100% right, I guess you know your Westerns really well. We'll get back to it at the end of the show. Fact or Fiction is a series of segments we do every once in a while where we talk about stories that are told and retold and retold about the movies, and they may or may not be true, so we'll get down to the truth of things. So this week, I got five stories that are about sort of the idiosyncrasies of fame, the weird things that happen because you're famous. And one of the things is that in a position of power, because if you have fame, you probably have power. If you're famous because you make money for the movies, you can make some strange demands when somebody asks you to star in a movie. And here's one about Steve McQueen. When he was offered one of the lead roles in The Towering Inferno, which was this disaster movie about a skyscraper on fire. It's probably the best disaster movie off the top of my head, but at least from that time. But he was going to play opposite Paul Newman. And you have to understand, McQueen and Newman were just amazing icons of cool and macho leading man types. And so this was going to be a real event to put him in the same movie. And McQueen was undoubtedly aware of that. And so what he insisted is that, or at least allegedly insisted, is that
okay, to do the movie, he and Paul Newman had to be given diagonal billing. And this is an interesting term. It means that one name appears in the upper right and one in the lower left. So the names can be read in either order, depending on whether you go left to right or top to bottom. It's a way of equating the scales. And he also insisted that the script be adjusted so that he and Newman would have exactly the same number of lines. Now, Stephen, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
I'm going to go with fact. That sounds kind of reasonable, actually.
Yeah, and it is completely true. McQueen and Newman were, you know, powerhouses, and he was just... It would be like kind of Pacino and De Niro in Heat, that kind of just star power meeting. And so, you know, McQueen was savvy about that and wanted to make sure the two of them were on equal footing. Well, we got another story about deal-making, and this would be Jennifer Lopez. Not quite the macho icon of cool, but...
yeah, not quite. Pretty close.
In her film Angel Eyes, Lopez decided that she wanted to be known as J-Lo, and that's about when that happened. And the film's billing should therefore be changed to read J-Lo instead of Jennifer Lopez. But the demand came 2 weeks before the film opened, and all the posters and prints had been produced already. And it was a point of considerable animosity that the studio refused to reprint them with the corrected credit, crediting her as J-Lo. So, is this fact, fiction, or a little of both?
Man, that sounds completely and totally insane, which is why I'm going to go with true.
Well, it is completely and totally insane, and a complete fabrication, actually. It started out as a humor column posted on the iFilm website, and it imagines this conversation between Jennifer Lopez's agent and the studio executive at Warner Brothers. And for some reason, this evolved into something that people were mistaking for the actual truth, but it is entirely made up. But I like your reasoning, though. That was a good guess on those grounds. Moving on, well, we're going to go a bit earlier and talk about something that happens as a result of fame. In 1915, Charlie Chaplin's best work was still ahead of him, but his stardom was absolutely on fire, and his little tramp character was one of the most recognizable movie characters. There was this fad at the time going around the nation to hold these contests, these Charlie Chaplin look-alike contests. See who could imitate the Little Tramp character the best and, you know, get all the accoutrements on and do the walk and everything. Well, there's a story going around that Charlie Chaplin himself once entered a Charlie Chaplin look-alike contest and lost it. Stephen, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
Oh, man, I've heard this story before. The way I heard it was Chaplin came in second or third or something like that. I want to say it's a little bit of both, but I'm not sure exactly.
Okay, well, your version is absolutely a little bit of both. My version was a true story. The version that usually gets told says, you know, he came in second to his brother or third or whatever, and his brother won, you know. He didn't lose to his brother. He didn't come in second. Actually, this real story's better. He didn't even make the finals. So this was a contest held somewhere in California, and he lost it. He told a reporter at the time that he wanted to finally just give lessons on how to do the walk because it was being done so badly. Speaking of Charlie Chaplin, we got another one about him. Considerably later on in time, though. He died in 1977 and was buried in Switzerland. That part I will confirm is true. But there's a story that says his coffin was dug up less than a year later and carried off and held for ransom. Is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
You know, I might as well just keep my streak alive today and go with fact. Because I'm just going to guess that they're all true.
Okay. Well, you're right in this case. It is true. A couple of guys... You know, got together and did this. They dug it up and buried it somewhere else and called up his widow, you know, if you want to see the remains alive again. And I don't know how it actually went down, but sent her a picture of the coffin and maybe chipped a piece off it and sent it in the mail as this eerie warning. I don't know. Anyway, they made crazy demands for money, and the police started watching all the payphones because they had tracked the calls down to a payphone somewhere. And eventually they caught him, and the coffin was recovered. So, last story, here's another one frequently told about a famous person's remains. This is a very common story. I have no idea why people are so fascinated by it, though. True or not, you know, I've heard this more than anything. Anyway, it's that after his death, Walt Disney's body was cryogenically frozen and interred beneath the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disneyland. Now, is that really what happened to Walt Disney, or are they just making it up?
Oh, that's totally false. What actually happened was he was cryogenically frozen, and his brain was put inside the animatronic Mr. Lincoln at Disneyland in the Hall of Presidents. That's some of the Pirates of the Caribbean, a bunch of nonsense, obviously.
Yeah, right. Your version is correct. Either that, or he was really just cremated in December 1966, and his ashes are located at a park in Glendale, California. One of those two stories is the real truth, but this Pirates of the Caribbean thing is so silly.
One of my favorite parts about actually going out to the movie theaters has always been that you get to see movie trailers. And nowadays, when you can watch every trailer currently in release at Apple.com or whatever, I don't know, there's something not quite as special about seeing those trailers in the movie theaters. But I want to take a minute just to sort of celebrate movie trailers in our top six list this week, because I love them. And we're going to talk about the top six movie trailers and teasers. And if you don't know, a teaser is pretty much the same thing as a movie trailer, except it usually comes out quite a bit earlier, and it may or may not actually have any footage from the movie itself. A lot of the most famous teasers are kind of like shorter little interesting snippets to get you excited about the movie before the official trailer comes out. So, one other thing about this list, Sam and I collaborated a little bit so we didn't duplicate any choices, because these are all pretty short, so we don't want to have a list that had too many that were exactly the same. So normally we don't, but this time we did, so just know that going in. All right, my number six is a great teaser from 1999. It was the Austin Powers 2 teaser, which, if you remember at the time, this was right before episode 1 had come out, and this was back when people were going to see, like, The Siege or Wing Commander just to see that episode 1 teaser trailer. I remember sitting through all of Wing Commander thinking...
Wait, episode 1 of what?
Star Wars.
Oh.
Yeah, so I remember actually sitting through Wing Commander just because I had already paid to see it, because I wanted to see the Star Wars trailer, and thinking that, boy, the Star Wars trailer was much, much better than the movie. But anyway, around the same time, the folks over at New Line released this trailer that starts off with heavy breathing and some voiceover talking about, you know, many years ago a war was fought and an empire was destroyed, and we see this dark figure sitting on a chair, and it swivels around, and it's Mike Myers as Dr. Evil, and he says, what, you're expecting somebody else? A very funny line, and the best part of the trailer, or the teaser rather, because it turns out to be for Austin Powers 2, The Spy Who Shagged Me, is this voiceover that goes, if you see one movie this summer, see Star Wars. But if you see two, see Austin Powers 2, which I always thought was... And I always got a big laugh back in the day, and I've always really enjoyed that trailer, kind of, you know, mocking it and making fun of the hype around the teaser trailer for episode 1.
Yeah, you know what's funny about that is it's a reference to another trailer, too. I mean, that line, you were expecting somebody else, was... Of course, Austin Powers is a parody of James Bond, but that was a line of the GoldenEye, I think, trailer when that came out. Anyway... my number six is for a movie that... Well, actually, your number six was for a bad movie as well. Mine is the trailer for Twister. And I remember being very impressed. I'm not sure if it had the cow. That's what everybody remembers in the movie, is the cow flying through the air. But the end of the trailer has a scene that isn't in the movie, and it's a... I forget if it's an oil tanker or tractor trailer or something, but some huge vehicle just lifted off in the air and is flying around inside the tornado, and... wow, I mean, and this was 1996. CGI special effects were pretty new. I mean, we'd seen Jurassic Park, but even so, the different things that you could do with CG was still being experimented with, and this was a really impressive thing to see. Disappointing, actually, that wasn't in the movie, but the other thing about this trailer is it was the first to sort of introduce a real fad that happened with trailers. I don't see it so much anymore, where you have the big, exciting, action-packed kind of montage, and then you cut to the credits, and it looks like you're winding down, but then all of a sudden you get like two or three seconds of something after the credits in the trailer, and a big music chord or something, definitely a smash cut into something, just to give you one last shock before ending the trailer. And I think this was the first one to really do that, the Twister one. It had something flying at you all of a sudden, and then it would go black again.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. That is, that became, I guess, probably a total cliche in a movie trailer. It's like the part where they have in the wacky comedy, the guy going, "What the?" and they cut to an explosion or something. But you know, that little last comeback from black for 1 second, it's kind of cool. I don't mind that. I think it's a cool cliche. I kind of like the cliches in movie trailers in the same way that I kind of like cliches in movies kind of fun sometimes. Well, my number five is another teaser. I had a lot of teasers on my list. My number five is another teaser, and what I love for it is that it barely even mentions the actual movie. And no, it's not the recent J.J. Abrams untitled whatever the heck thing in front of Transformers, but it's from a couple years ago, the movie I, Robot, before they actually released the trailers for it with Will Smith. They had this series, or maybe just the one, I think, actually, this fake commercial in front of movies where it was advertising this robot that was for sale, the new robot that's sort of the plot of the movie. And it's very, very full of in-jokes and very clever. And I don't think, unless you knew what you're looking at, that most people probably got that it was exactly a trailer for a movie, kind of a cool advertising campaign. It was part of this whole, like, alternate reality game thing that they did for the marketing. But, you know, they had all these things like, this NS5 unit is three laws compliant, you know, referencing the Asimov three laws of robotics. All sorts of fun stuff, just really clever. And in fact, that trailer, considerably more clever than most of the film itself. So, you know, better to do that than Will Smith making wacky jokes about robots.
Yeah, but iRobot was a pretty good movie, I thought.
Yeah, it was alright.
Actually, you know, you mentioned this trailer, and you mentioned J.J. Abrams, and that made me think of Lost in those Hanzo Foundation commercials, which... sort of the same idea, I guess. Number five for me is another one that really impressed me in the theater, and this time the movie did live up to my expectations, and then some. Well, in the late 90s, you know, we were hearing that this guy, Peter Jackson, was going to be making something based on Tolkien. I didn't know if it was The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings. Oh, then it turned out it was going to be Lord of the Rings. Okay, how's he going to do that? Wow, it's going to be three movies. Oh, that's really interesting. And we just, I was paying a lot of attention to the development of these movies. And the big thing was, you know, is he going to do it justice or not? And, you know, gosh, there hadn't been really any fantasy movies to speak of that had been really great. There have been some really good ones, but few, even those few and far between, most of them were pretty terrible. And is this guy, Peter Jackson, going to do all right? Well, I'd seen a couple of Peter Jackson movies, Heavenly Creatures, and I thought he had the talent, but he really hadn't done anything this big. So is it going to be good? Is it not? How's it going to go? And when the trailer came out, it solidified everything for me. Yes, this is going to be the event beyond what you could hope for. It had all the visuals just not only flawless, but just really impressive, those New Zealand landscapes. The shot I remember in particular is the establishing shot of Hobbiton, and you see that they've created Hobbiton in every just wonderful details, and just looked fantastic. And the music was beautiful, and at that point I knew that this was going to be something to see. So even now, remembering, I don't think I've been more energized by a movie trailer than when I saw the one for Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a cool trailer, and it was just like, oh, good, this is not some cheesy, terrible cash-in project I think we were all afraid it might have turned into. It kind of reminds me, there was something similar that the studios did when they released teasers for both Superman in 78 and the original, well, not the original, but the Batman film from 1989, the Tim Burton one. They released teaser trailers really early on into the theaters just to say to fans, look, we're taking this seriously. You're not getting super lame, low-budget movies like you've maybe seen in the past. So I think it was important that when New Line released that trailer for Lord of the Rings, that they tell you, this is a real movie. It's not some low-budget, cheesy, lame-o hack job. And I think we're all just, you know, very, very gratified and happy to see that. And it was another one of those trailers. I remember it was a big event when that came out, kind of like the Episode 1 trailer, big deal.
Yeah.
Well, my number four is another teaser trailer, and I think it's the way to advertise a sequel. And it was the very first teaser trailer from Terminator 2 back in the early 90s. And if you don't remember this teaser trailer, it's got no footage from the movie. Instead, what you should see is a Terminator being assembled. You get the robotic endoskeleton being put together, all these sparks, and then it gets pushed in this mold, and then the mold pulls apart, and out steps Arnold, and he's got flesh over him, and he's flexing his gigantic, you know, bicep, and just looking at the camera, and his red eyes flash out, and you just see, boosh, boom, Terminator 2, Judgment Day. And of course you hear Arnold just saying, I'll be back. And oh man, that was a cool moment. I remember back in the day, and there's been a lot of spoofs of that kind of trailer too, I think, since then. But that's a great moment, and it just doesn't tell you anything about the movie, which is cool because Terminator 2, unfortunately, or the later marketing spoiled it. Has a really, really great first act twist in it, and it's a cool movie, and it just says you're getting more of what you loved before, and we're gonna do it right. It just that was a neat moment to see.
Yeah, I had the privilege of seeing Terminator 2 without knowing the twist, and so that was a real exciting thing. Yeah, it is nice. A trailer, it burns me up when you see a trailer, and then you feel like you don't really need to see the movie because you've seen everything that, you know the story, you know how it's going to end, because if you can sum up the whole story in a trailer anyway, then you probably know how it's going to end. I don't know, I can't stand trailers that give everything away, and so if they shoot new footage for it, then that's really good, but unfortunately too expensive, so it doesn't happen too much. Number four for me, I think it was the first trailer that came out for Kill Bill before it was split into volumes 1 and 2, because it does have footage from both in, and it has this great music, and I actually like the mix of the music and the trailer better than the actual movie, but what's it from?
A Japanese movie that I don't know the name of off the top of my head. The song is called Battle Without Honor or Humanity from a Japanese film. So a great example of Tarantino repurposing music from something else, which he's so good at doing.
Yeah. So, yeah, fantastic music. So, I mean, that sets the stage, and it was another one of these things, like with Lord of the Rings for me, it was just a thrill to see the trailer and all the different visuals that accompanied it and the crazy things that Tarantino was doing with the genre. And, you know, she goes to an old master, and this was from the second one, I think, so it was definitely before it was split, but she goes to an old kung fu master or something, and she trains in the woods, and she tries to hit him with a sword, he jumps up and lands on top of the sword and is standing there. And so, you know, maybe that sounds stupid, but if you know a bit about martial arts movies, you kind of know that he's sort of paying homage to that style and making fun of it at the same time with a joke like that. But it was a really interesting thing to see a lot of things that weren't really in American movies at that time, and really still aren't, but they're a bit more familiar. I'm talking like Kill Bill was made 30 years ago. I guess the infiltration of Asian cinema has been very recent. But yeah, a really exciting montage of images from Kill Bill. Not really any dialogue to speak of. There's like two lines of dialogue, and the rest is just that great music and the incredible visuals.
Yeah, it's so cool. I remember we'd waited so long after Jackie Brown for a new Tarantino movie. I remember like following all his projects. He was going to do the Vega Brothers, he was going to do this for seemingly forever. And I remember just reading about it and following it, and just always sounded so cheesy. I didn't get how it was going to work. And then you see Uma, and you see it, and you see her in that yellow jumpsuit with a katana. And, oh boy, my friends and I just geeked out on that trailer for months and months and months. So excited for it. I loved that trailer. It would have been on my list, except, well, like I said, we collaborated. So, well, my number three trailer is something that did a real interesting thing. It made me see a movie that I initially absolutely did not want to see, because I had seen another movie starring Keanu Reeves as a computer hacker, and that was a little movie called Johnny Mnemonic, and that is one of the worst big budget movies I've ever seen in my entire life. It's just absolutely abominable. And so when I heard this, someone else was making a sci-fi action movie starring Keanu Reeves as a computer hacker, I thought, this is going to be just a disaster. What the heck are they doing this for? And I saw a trailer for a little movie called The Matrix. And it was a weird, trippy trailer that had all these crazy, crazy special effects in it. I think I saw the trailer maybe late 98 or so, because the movie came out in April of 99. And after I watched that trailer, which didn't give away the plot of the movie, which just set up, there's a strange world, interesting stuff's going on, and asks you, you know, what is the Matrix? And you hear Lawrence Fishburne's voice telling you that no one can be told what the Matrix is, and you see that great bullet time sequence of Keanu dodging the bullets on the rooftop, and you're like, oh. So I was there on opening day to see the Matrix, and I wasn't disappointed either, thankfully. But yeah, I mean, if you can convince me to get excited about a Keanu Reeves movie, you have a great trailer.
Yeah, apparently you do. I think I saw The Matrix without having seen the trailer first. I'm not sure how that happened. Number three for me is a complete unashamed cheat. It's the worst cheat I think I've ever committed. But my number three is every movie trailer between 1930 and 1960. And the reason I can include such a broad spectrum of trailers, hundreds and hundreds of them, is because it's really all the same trailer. It's a scene of some characters having a dramatic conflict, and then some words kind of wipe onto the screen. We talked about wipes way back. If you remember what they are, you know what I'm talking about. And the words are things like, a smashing, crashing, dashing picture. And then we cut to another scene, and there's a romance scene, and then it cuts to some more words that say things like, it's got all-star names, it's got action-packed thrills, it's got adventure-loaded romance, it's got amazing color. And then you see words swivel down from the top, like they're folding down onto the screen over the image, and it says, sing, swing, entertainment that's hep and sizzling. And then you cut to a scene where the woman's slapping him, so you know there's some spice in the romance, and it says, here comes happiness in a merry medley of romance and rhythm. And then you see some chase or something, a car chase, or maybe running through the streets or the woods or something, and then it says, she hated to be mastered, but she learned how to like it from the man who put the man in romance. And I swear, they're all the same. They're all like this, and they're all great.
Oh,
you don't
yeah.
need to see any particular one. Just see a few, and you got the general idea. I guess this goes back to the taglines trivia question we had, but just wonderful trailers. And I wish they'd still advertise movies like this in a way.
Yeah, you know, I remember that sort of retro spoof film from a couple years ago, The Lost Skeleton of Cadavra,
did a
spoof of those, which was a really cool thing to see. There's a revival house I go to up in Hollywood sometimes, and one of the greatest things about going there is they always double features, and before and between the movies, they show all the classic trailers of movies that they have coming up, and then the original theatrical trailers often. And it is cool seeing those crazy. I mean, we've got the thing they have to do is tell you the name of the studio. It's like Warner Presents. That's always such an important thing to highlight. You never even mention that today. You don't hear Don LaFontaine saying, Warner Brothers presents a world where, whatever. Those old trailers are cool. All right, well, one of the classic trailers with one of the most classic taglines ever is for a little film called Alien from 1979. And the original theatrical trailer is completely without dialogue. You see the shot of this egg, and then it opens, and you see all of these rushed shots of the film and action, and you get a sense that some crazy stuff is going on, and then it just sort of ends with that tagline, you know, it's Alien, then in space, no one can hear you scream. And it's so cool because, of course, there's no dialogue throughout the trailer, just giving it a really creepy edge. It's so cool. And then I like the other trailers in the Alien series that follow, because at least one of the trailers for each one kind of played around with that format. I remember when the Alien box set came out, and I got one of the first things I did was go through and watch all the trailers for all four. And it's kind of interesting watching how they play around with that same teaser over and over.
Yeah, I think horror movies lend themselves to that kind of trailer, and it is nice when they do that, because it does give you a sense of the atmosphere without really telling you any story at all. Number two for me, well, it's another kind of cheat. We talked about Hitchcock. It's going to be any trailer where Alfred Hitchcock appears in person, especially Psycho and the Birds. Now, toward the later part of his career, he did this quite frequently. He had been hosting Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and if you've seen his introductions to that, you know how absolutely hilarious he can be. He's you know, almost a stand-up comic in addition to being a director. But his trailer for Psycho is really interesting. You should not see it before seeing the movie, because it doesn't give anything away in the sense that it doesn't really show you any original footage, but basically it's a tour of the Bates Motel. He takes you around and shows you different key places in the house. This scene was where the second murder was committed, and it's just cracking a bunch of jokes, and he has that dry sense of humor. In The Birds, he says he's going to say a few words about his forthcoming lecture about the birds, and he's talking about how proud the birds must have felt to have their feathers plucked out to brighten man's drab life, you know, for, putting a quill in a hat, or using it to write with, or eating birds for food, or stealing eggs. And he's talking about all the different things that have exemplified the great relationship that man and birds have have had through nature. And it ends with him getting bit by his pet bird and his wondering, why did he do that? In North by Northwest, he has this, he's going to plan this little holiday fun trip. You don't find a tasteful little murder on every guided tour now, do you? Which he says after cutting back from Cary Grant watching somebody get stabbed in the back in front of him. And for Frenzy, he's it opens on him floating in the Thames like a dead body, and then it cuts to a close-up of him lying in the water, and he says, I dare say you are wondering why I am floating around London like this. Just great, great stuff to watch Hitchcock do his movie trailers in toward the end of his career.
Yeah, those are really hilarious, though I like the Psycho one best of all, I think, just because it's got that great...
I think so.
This is the final shot where it cuts from him opening a shower curtain to Janet Leigh screaming, which is it's going to be a cool shock to the audience to see that. Yeah, Hitchcock was great. Those are awesome. Wow. You know, you mentioned that you thought horror movies lent themselves to showing atmosphere, and I agree 100%, which is why my number one is the teaser trailer for Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. That famous shot of, it's about a minute and a half long, it's a single shot, and we're just sitting there watching elevators. There's just this elevators, and we're just hearing this weird soundtrack. There's some music, and it also sounds like maybe some insects or something on it, and slowly this text scroll that tells us, oh, The Shining by Stanley Kubrick, starring Jack Nicholson, and based on the Stephen King novel, and then all of a sudden, toward the end of it, blood just starts pouring out of the elevators and just covers everything. The furniture in the hallway gets lifted up, the camera lens is covered in blood, and that's the entire trailer, and it is creepy as all get out. I mean, it's pretty creepy before the blood shows up. That's a spooky soundtrack that's got going on, but then once it comes, it's such a famous image, probably the most famous image from The Shining, and one of the most famous images in horror history, and just perfectly conveys so much about the film without giving it away, which is great because, you know, it's a movie that has some interesting twists to it.
Yes, that shot is a wonderfully effective shot. We talked a bit about how much trouble it was to make back when, I guess we were talking about Kubrick. But yeah, I love it. It's a very memorable image. I mean, you just don't forget that one. My number one is a totally different sort of thing, though, and it had to be my number one because I have never tired of watching it again and again. I have not even seen the movie that it's for. I've just watched the trailer again and again, and I think after a month or two, and I haven't seen it in a while, I think, I could go with a good laugh, so I'll watch this trailer, and I laugh just as hard as the first time. It's the trailer for the movie called The Comedian. And so I guess it's a pseudo-documentary by Jerry Seinfeld about something in the life of a comedian or something. I don't even know what it is. The trailer, which has, I assume, very little to do with it, is about the making of the trailer, and it has one of the, you know how you hear the same voices in the movie trailers over and over again? The one you hear most often is Don LaFontaine. He's the guy who says, in a world where, etc. But there's another guy with a very similar voice named Hal Douglas, who also does these as well, and he appears in person in this trailer for The Comedian, and he's getting into the sound booth, and the guy is monitoring it outside, saying, okay, The Comedian movie trailer take one, and Hal Douglas is off to do his thing, and he starts off saying, in a world where, and no, he interrupts him, nah, there's no in a world, this is just a movie about a comedian, so we're not going to do that. But he can't get out of the cliches. He'll start with in a land, and then he'll say in a time, and no, that's no good either, it's about a comedian, okay, one man, and he keeps getting interrupted, no, that's not what we want, it's not that kind of trailer, we're not using the cliches, but he cannot, he has been so used to spouting these cliches, he cannot say anything else, and he just gets faster and faster, when your life is no longer your own, when everything you know is wrong, and there's nothing more to say, is there? It's just a great bit of comic timing, actually. It's a real comic creation, not just an advertisement. It actually works quite poorly for an advertisement, if I haven't even seen it, but as a work of comedy in itself, the pacing of it is just flawless, and it's just wonderful dialogue, and Hal Douglas has really good facial reactions as well as having that great voice. So, yeah, my number one, easy.
Yeah, as an advertising choice, it is interesting. You make a movie with one of the most bankable guys in the world in it, Jerry Seinfeld, and don't put him in the trailer. But it is absolutely hilarious. And I do remember when it came out how freaking obsessed you were with it, Sam. I think you just loved it. But for good reason. It's a great, great trailer and absolutely positively hilarious. I think on the website we should have links to all of these trailers because I think they're all online just about. Certainly think God bless YouTube. So we'll definitely go. If you haven't seen The Comedian, I would recommend it's the one you go watch because everyone will just die laughing. Hilarious stuff. And anyway, let's recap my top six list of movie trailers and teasers. Number six, the teaser for Austin Powers 2, The Spy Who Shagged Me. Number five, the teaser for iRobot, the fake commercial for the NS5 robot. Number four, the original teaser for Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Number three, the Matrix trailer, which convinced me to watch a Keanu Reeves computer hacker movie. Number two, the Alien trailer in space, no one can hear you scream. And number one, that just fantastic shot of blood pouring from an elevator for The Shining.
And my number six, the trailer for Twister, substantially better than the movie itself. Number five, the trailer for The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. Number four, the trailer for Kill Bill, before it was split into two parts. Number three, every movie trailer between about 1930 and about 1960. Number two, any trailer in which Hitchcock appears himself, notably Psycho and the Birds are the two best. And number one, The Comedian. Well, a while ago we talked about screwball comedies, and I want to follow up that discussion with a look at the work of Preston Sturges, a director of screwball comedies, just about exclusively screwball comedies. He did one or two that fell outside that genre, but there's a number of his films that are very respected and considered great today, but I don't know, my experience has kind of been that you don't see a Preston Sturges movie just accidentally. You kind of have to seek him out, and maybe see the Lady Eve or Sullivan's Travels, which I think are his two best known and most respected, but so many of his movies were very, very great, and you kind of have to seek him out to see those movies, and they are worth seeking out. They are all on DVD, I think, or at least most of them. His screwballs have their own flavor to them. They don't feel quite the same as the others. He has his own style. They do share the same characteristics of the genre as we talked about, but is his own kind of take on social satire and personal relationships. He started out as a playwright in the 1920s, and when he was successful, Hollywood got a hold of him, and he started writing screenplays, starting in 1930. Initially, he wasn't too successful, but eventually he made it big with the 1933 film The Power and the Glory, which is a drama with Spencer Tracy that allegedly inspired the jumping around in time structure of Citizen Kane. So a rare drama for him, but he also wrote the screenplay for 20th Century, one of the great early screwballs, this one directed by Howard Hawks. He was one of the first writers to be given a percentage of the profits as part of his contract. That was a rare thing in that day.
Thus, I'm sure, also became one of the first writers to get screwed out of the percentage of the profits he was owed by creative accounting.
Yes, that's a standard practice. Get a percentage of the profits and then not get them. Because, you know, Titanic, somehow on paper, it lost money. Anyway, we talk a lot about people who didn't become acclaimed until much later on after their careers were over and stuff, but Sturges, the point is, he was hugely respected right off the bat. Well, eventually, he wanted to direct his own scripts himself rather than writing for other directors, although I don't think he really had any particular complaints about how other directors handled his material. But he sold the rights to his script for The Great McGinty that he wrote for $1. Or $10, depending on who you ask. It depends on who's telling the story, I think. But on the condition that he got to direct the movie himself, so the studio said, hey, good deal, go ahead and direct it. Well, it went on to win him the first ever Academy Award for writing. So a pretty cheap Oscar-winning screenplay. And from then on, he gradually sought more and more creative control. Absolutely not hard to see why he was so respected, even compared with other screwball comedies, a whole genre renowned for its great writing. Sturges' scripts just sparkle. Sharp wit, wonderfully timed, just the right tone. And there's this weird mix of cynicism in the sentiment that kind of lets you intake the material on two levels at the same time. You can take it as sentiment, and you can also laugh at it at the same time as being a quirkiness of human behavior, what's happening. It's a funny way that his movies tend to work. You'd think two different tones like this at the same time would conflict with each other, but they really don't. Another thing that sets Sturges' work apart is he relied more on pratfalls and slapstick than most of the other screwball directors. Again, this doesn't sound like it should work. How are you going to take these incredibly smart scripts with great dialogue and so much humor in the words and make that work in a movie where people are tripping over things and knocking things down all the time? But it works. I mean, you have this scene of William Demarest grouching at somebody, and that's funny, and at the end of the scene, he tries to kick the other guy in the rear, misses, falls down, fade out. I mean, it's lowbrow, highbrow comedy. Now, he worked within the studio system, contracted to a studio, but he was unusually powerful within it. I mean, he won an Oscar right off the bat. He got progressive deals that other writers and directors didn't get, so, you know, people just really liked him. He had a lot of power. And in the mid-40s, though, he took a pay cut to work as an independent writer, producer, director, separate from the studio system. He was pretty much the first one in Hollywood since the studio system began to do this, the first major filmmaker to break away from the studio system. And that, unfortunately, seemed to tip him over the point at which too much creative power was too much. He kind of crashed and burned at that point and really only made one great film after that. It was kind of a case of burning brightly but burning out quick. And his career after that was never the same. So, you know, he might have been a little too successful, but he had a very short and very influential career. Now, he only directed 13 movies. One was redone by another director, and another was recut by the studio. So we won't credit or blame him for those, but the remaining 11, eight of them are truly great comedies. It's remarkable. 8 out of 11 great films. And maybe 6 of them among the greatest comedies of all time. And they hold up so well today. So it's definitely worth studying him. So let's talk a bit about some of them. The Great McGinty, 1940. A rare screwball comedy that delves into politics. Usually screwballs stay away from politics, except as social satire, maybe, but this one has a lot of the other elements in Screwball as well. It's about a tramp, so there's an element right there, a poor guy who commits voter fraud and thereby captures the interest of corrupt politicians interested in working with him, and maybe he'd be like to be the new mayor. They could set him up, and he can be kind of a puppet mayor, although he doesn't quite realize that yet. But anyway, so we're playing politics in a way that addresses the class hierarchy, and there's a marriage of convenience that is obviously going to turn into a real romance at some point, a classic screwball kind of situation. Wonderful writing, it goes without saying, and very short. That's another thing about Sturges. His movies tend to be pretty short. I'm not sure exactly how long this one is, maybe 1 hour and 10 minutes, as was his next movie, Christmas in July, and which is not about Christmas, actually. It's about a guy who is poor, who is tricked into thinking he has won an awful lot of money, and so he starts celebrating, and he starts buying all kinds of things on the credit that he has established, and then it turns out that it was his friends playing a joke on him, and they felt bad once it started getting out of control, but didn't really know how to stop it. A good movie, though, and definitely also fits into the screwball template and the themes that Sturges will be working with a lot, more than most screwball directors and writers interested in talking about the class hierarchy. And so after that, he made a movie called The Lady Eve. And, Stephen, I know you have stuff to talk about this, so why don't you go for it? The Lady Eve is great. It's my favorite. I think it's both our favorite Sturges movies.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I know it's my favorite by far. Lady Eve is on my short list of funniest movies ever, right up there with Dr. Strangelove and The General. I mean, just never ceases to amuse me to no end. Basic story, it's another sort of weird kind of class story, but with a twist. This is about someone who's pretending to have class to woo a rich guy. And I think this actually makes a very interesting comparison piece when you talk about Sturges versus other screwball films. There's a lot of similarities sort of to maybe in some ways bringing up Baby here, sort of with Henry Fonda as a nebbish professor being wooed by a woman, in this case played by Barbara Stanwyck. Renwick. She's quite a bit different than the Katharine Hepburn character in Baby, but still, you know, you want to see Preston Sturges take on similar kind of material in a lot of different ways. I definitely think, you know, one of the things about Sturges is his films were always a little bit more risque than other films of the era. Here, some great scenes with Stanwyck trying to seduce the Fonda character, and it's got a cool kind of two-part structure. The first part where she's a con woman trying to con him, and then later, after he discovers her rouge, she pretends to be this this rich, distinguished English aristocrat to win his heart back, and then of course he thinks she's somebody else and has to reveal. Anyway, just constant wacky misadventures, really, really sparkling script, and so funny, and I love the kind of interesting, strange structure to it. Not a lot of movies have basically a two-act structure. This one pretty much does, and it works.
Yeah, now, I like what you say about him pushing the boundaries. That's an important point to make, and I think it is directly because, as I said before, he had a lot of power and respect in Hollywood. People respected him and loved his writing and movies enough that they let him get away with things that other directors couldn't. That said, however, if you had your 8-year-olds watching this movie too, I don't think you'd bat an eye. And also, the same year, it was a great year for him, 1941, he made a movie called Sullivan's Travels, which is the other one, I think, that people most respect. This one, I think, is actually going to take fourth place for me, but I don't mean to say that it's a lesser movie. It is a great movie. Well, why don't you talk about this one, too, because I know you've seen this one and like it as well.
Yeah, I do like it. This one is a lot going on in it. Joel McCrea plays a Hollywood director who maybe is based a little bit on Sturges. You know, some differences, but certainly there's a little hint of autobiography here. He's this director of silly movies like Ants in Your Pants and that kind of thing. These really silly movies, and the studio heads want him to keep making silly, successful movies during the Great Depression. He wants to make this pretentious movie about the Great Depression and class struggles, and so to research it, he goes out pretending to be a homeless guy and winds up, and of course, comic misunderstandings, getting experiences he didn't expect, and at the end, comes to pretty much realize that maybe what you should really make, if you're really interested in helping out the lower classes, isn't depressing movies about how hard their existence is, but screwy, silly comedies.
Like Ants in Your Pants.
Right. Like great things like Ants in Your Pants of 39 or whatever it was called. Yeah, and I like how there's a lot going on here, a lot about the movies, and some great, great gags about Hollywood.
Yeah.
I love it. If they knew what they liked in Philadelphia, they wouldn't live in Philadelphia.
Yeah, it is one of the great movies about Hollywood, and I don't know if we missed that in our Movies About Movies Top 6. If we did miss it, we probably shouldn't have. But now I want to go back to the Coen brothers, actually, because this is a movie that inspired them in a big way. The obvious one is that the title of the movie, O Brother, Where Art Thou, which the Coen brothers made, comes from the title of the fictional movie in Sullivan's Travels that this guy wants to make. So that's an obvious connection there. But let me quote you some of the dialogue from Sullivan's Travels and see what other Coen brothers movie it reminds you of. You might have already guessed based on Steven's synopsis of the story. So yeah, the incredibly successful big shot producer wants to make a socially relevant drama, and he says, "This picture is an answer to communists. It shows we're awake and not dunking our heads in the sand like a bunch of ostriches. I want this picture to be a commentary on modern conditions, stark realism, and problems that confront the average man." And the guy he's talking to, you know, is still ingrained in the Ants in Your Pants type movie. He says, you know, but with a little sex. He says, a little, but I don't want to stress it. I want this picture to be a document. I want to hold a mirror up to life. I want this to be a picture of dignity, a true canvas of the suffering of humanity. But with a little sex. Yeah, with a little sex in it. More or less, this is a movie about the attitude of the Barton Fink character in that movie. The point of both movies is that neither one, Sullivan nor Barton Fink, knows the least little thing about living a life as a common man. But at least Sullivan makes an attempt to learn by going out into the streets, and he dresses up as a tramp and tries to live like one. Of course, the ultimate message is that the upper class is naive, and if they're moved by their guilt to make art about the common man, well, maybe they shouldn't assume that the common man is going to care about it. But a very entertaining movie. Well, like all of these, a lot of fun. As is The Palm Beach Story in 1942, one of my favorites. Again, another classic screwball type of situation where a marriage runs over the rocks because the woman can't stand being poor. So, yes, all the attributes of screwball coming into play here. Well, there's a millionaire and a misunderstanding and so on. It's a bit more down-to-earth, actually, than most screwball comedies are in other Sturges movies as well, although still pretty outrageous. And it manages to be pretty funny and also rather insightful about marriage and two people who love each other, but just have difficulty accepting their circumstances and how they deal with that. This is a bit more serious. It's just as funny, but the subject matter is taken a bit more serious, if you can get what I mean here. A bit less focused on the physical humor that Sturgis loved, and more on the verbal sparring and situational humor. It's pretty hilarious, and I just love how genuine it feels, as well as being pretty uproarious. Also uproarious and considerably more physical with an outlandish plot would be The Miracle of Morgan's Creek from 1944. So we're on the end of the golden age of screwball, but I don't want to imply that screwball ended. It did go on. There was 1-2-3 by Billy Wilder in 61, and Bogdanovich made What's Up Doc in 72. And, you know, screwball is so influential and modeled that even after it's over, filmmakers kind of harken back to certain aspects of it and try to use what worked in screwball. So we're at the end, but not really the end. At this time of The Miracle of Morgan's Creek. Anyway, it's about a very meek guy. Sturges like these kinds of heroes, like Dick Powell and Christmas in July, and just meek people who may have some inner strength but don't know it, and seem to be driven by circumstances and large forces and important people and government and business and so forth until they figure out how to take control of the situation. But Miracle at Morgan's Creek starred Eddie Bracken, who was just absolutely perfect at playing this type of character. He was wonderful. Oh, I don't know why he didn't get more work. It's funny just watching him. But anyway, he's unable to take control of even the simplest situation, with the result that the situation complicates itself again and again and again, and he's swept along by the tide. The humor comes along from him being pulled into one tight spot after another. Stephen, what do you think about this one?
You want to talk about Sturges pushing the boundaries of the era?
Whatever you want to say.
Yeah, no, that's what I just want to say, is that here's an example. The Hays Code, the production code, prohibited discussing pregnancy directly and showing pregnancy or childbirth. Here's a movie about a woman who gets knocked up by somebody one night while she's out drinking and has to figure out who the father is. Somehow, Sturges can make that story at a time when you can't directly show or discuss pregnancy. Just amazing.
Yeah.
And an absolutely hilarious movie to boot.
I mean, you can sort of see how the movie kind of pays a little, like a superficial nod to the production code, because what happens is, supposedly in a drunken state, they got married and then went to a hotel room or something, and so it's okay, we're adhering to the letter of the production code, but come on, this is extremely mature for 1944, which is when the production code rules were at their strictest. I mean, even earlier you could get away with more than you could in 1944, so, yeah. But it's used really well here. I mean, it's just one comic. I mean, the fact that this was such an outrageous and controversial, kind of scandalous thing to have happen, because of that, that's how it gets exploited for all the comic situations. Because here Eddie Bracken is, here this woman is, and they're in a real fix. It's not like today, where if that happened, the story would almost not even be interesting, because it's not a scandal. This movie is very daring and uses that for pretty hilarious comic situations that other movies just could not do. And also in 1944, he worked with Eddie Bracken again for Hail the Conquering Hero. Now, with this one, it's interesting to look at the wartime attitudes of the day. This was 1944, of course. World War II was in full swing, and, you know, it was winding down, but it wasn't over. And Eddie Bracken plays this young man who tries to join the Marines, but he's rejected for having hay fever. And so, rather than disappoint his mother, who is quite proud to have her son go off and join the Marines, he decides he's going to pretend he's serving in the Marines while he goes off to work in a shipyard somewhere. Well, obviously, this charade is going to escalate and spiral out of control. Suddenly, he finds himself mistaken for a war hero, and has a big homecoming and all that kind of thing. Again, the situation that Eddie Bracken plays wonderfully. He knows he's in trouble as things complicate, but he doesn't know what to do about it. Actually, as I hear myself describing this, it kind of reminds me of a lot of other comedies which are really frustrating and kind of dumb. Tons and tons of comedies are based on misunderstandings, and they're frustrating, I think, because there's no good reason that the characters just can't talk it out and clear it up. You ever had that sense in a comedy where you're just frustrated because somebody doesn't know something that would change everything, and instead the character that you were rooting for is getting beaten up and ostracized and everything? Yeah, that's not really that fun, actually, if it's played too thickly. But the thing is, people don't communicate, and then once the characters do learn the truth, then they react with these unrealistically exaggerated feelings of betrayal, and the screenplay has to crank through all that stuff that's not that fun. Well, Hail a Conquering Hero, and in fact many of these great classic screwball comedies manage, I guess just through great writing, manage to pull off these kinds of escalating misunderstandings without being frustrating. Sturgis was a brilliant writer, and he obviously knew how to do these sorts of things right, hit the right emotional notes. Now, after this film, however, things did dry up for Sturgis, as we said. He broke with the studio system, went independent, and I suppose that's probably what messed things up, but his next film was The Sin of Harold Diddlebach in 1947. It took 3 years to get the next movie made. And this is interesting, though, even though it's pretty flawed, because it's the last film of Harold Lloyd, the great silent clown. You might not have heard of him. I did have a post about him on our website, allmovietalk.com. Search for Harold Lloyd, and you might find it. He was, you know, one of the kings of silent comedy, along with Chaplin and Keaton, and it's just he is not as well remembered. But he had retired 9 years earlier, and Sturgis wrote a screenplay for him expressly to lure him out of retirement, and it worked. He came back out of retirement and he made this movie. Unfortunately, it's not that great. It does have moments of brilliance in it, and Lloyd had a wonderful voice to complement his screen persona from his silent movies. A lot of silent stars did not have great voices. He did, at least it suited his personality, which is, again, kind of a meek guy, the Eddie Bracken type. But I think the editing is the problem with the movie, though. There's these scenes of just hilarious stuff, and then there'd be a slapstick scene that doesn't really work, but it'd still be okay if it didn't go on for hours, it feels like, before it cuts back to something funny. So it's neat to see Lloyd and Sturgis working together, kind of two great comedic giants from different eras working together. But if you're not interested in that specifically, you might want to skip the movie. His last great movie, however, would come the next year with Unfaithfully Yours. And he did make movies after this, just not as successful anymore. He said that, "I had so very much for so very long. It is quite natural for the pendulum to swing the other way for a while, and I really cannot and will not complain." So a nice remark about his own career. But, you know, Unfaithfully Yours, 1948, starring the incomparable Rex Harrison, from My Fair Lady, you might know him from that, is a guy who thinks his wife is being unfaithful to him, and his imagination runs away with him, and of course there are misunderstandings, and eventually he's driven to kill his wife, or at least try to, and that's where the slapstick angle kicks in. There's a number of slapstick situations as he tries to execute his plans, or at least imagine them. He plays an orchestra conductor, and as he's conducting, the dramatic notes in what he's conducting kind of correspond to what he's imagining. He's imagining his revenge or something. He kind of gets obsessed with it, but he keeps bungling the job. So kind of a dark movie, actually, especially for 1948. Maybe that's why it wasn't as successful as it maybe should have been. It was remade in 1984 with Dudley Moore, and that film is also pretty good, but this one has Sturgis back on form with this wonderful dialogue and comic timing, so it's definitely worth looking at, even though it's from after his career sort of declined. And it is recognized as a pretty great film today. So that's a few of his movies. That's actually most of the movies that he made, and they're all worth checking out. So we'll have the list in full on allmovietalk.com if you need to use that for a reference. And check out some of his movies. I think they're all on DVD. Most of them are anyway. Rent them. I think you'll be surprised how entertaining they are. It's the end of the show. Stephen, do you remember the trivia question that I asked earlier on?
Yeah, I remember it, but can I hear the choices again?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Let's repeat the choices. The question was, which of these actors did not appear in the John Ford classic My Darling Clementine? The choices would be A, Henry Fonda, B, Linda Darnell, C, Victor Mature, D, Walter Brennan, E, Ward Bond, and F, Snoop Dogg. What do you think? What do you think about this one?
All right, well, my first inclination...
You got a 1 out of 6 chance here.
Yeah. My first inclination is to say Snoop Dogg, because I don't remember him being in that film. But I realize you're trying to be tricky here, Sam.
Yeah.
Which of these actors don't appear in the film. Snoop Dogg's not an actor. He's a lot of things, but I would not call him an actor. So I'm going to go with Henry Fonda.
Actually, he was in the film. The answer was Snoop Dogg, and you were so close there. It was an especially tricky question because I anticipated that you would think it was a tricky question, and so I made it the obvious answer. And I guess it worked. How'd you do at home? If you got that one right, I think we would love to hear about it because it was a very difficult question. So post to our website, allmovietalk.com. And that's the end of episode 50. We do have two more episodes for you coming up, but we also have more things on the website, allmovietalk.com. Go there to read more about what we have to say about movies, including vintage posts on Thursdays, a look at the times of the 1920s when movies were at their height of popularity and sound was just around the corner. I'm not sure how long I'll be continuing those, but they'll go on a bit after the podcast ends, so definitely check that site out. And also go to rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com, for general entertainment features. Steven, what do we got coming up?
Well, episode 51 is our second-to-last episode, the penultimate episode, if you will like to use fancy terms. We're going to talk about classic westerns as the first entry in a two-part film-style spotlight looking at the western. We'll also be talking about some other stuff, as well as our top six list, performances by directors. So we'll be talking about great roles that people who we'd mostly think of as directors have done. If you want to prepare your list ahead of time, we'll be back next week, Tuesday, September 18th.
Cut! Actually, I changed my mind. Let's keep this going and see how it goes. What do you mean it already stopped? I want to keep going. No, that was before. I want to keep going now just to see how the... Look, what do I pay you people for? I'm the director. You're supposed to do what I tell you. I'm telling you to keep going.